Hello, everybody. Hello, Raymond.
Hello. How are you?
You mean all of us, or?
All of us.
Yeah, I think okay. Raymond, can you put the video in such a way that you see the man?
The man, okay.
Ah, yeah, okay. So I'll show to the public what the other public doesn't see. So it's the president of Switzerland giving a speech about le rire, so the laughter. It's in French, though. But basically, he is speaking to the Swiss people about laughter and how laughter can heal sick people. Because it's he speaks to the Swiss population on the day of the ill people. What we see is the president in front, and then we see a fountain on the right side. We see a bit of a hilly landscape in the background. Then we see some modern, very expensive architecture, and then also two buildings. And now he's gonna speak to he's gonna teach us how to love in a healthy way.
Malade, chers proches, amis et connaissances de personnes malades, chers personnels soignants. Rire, c'est bon pour la santé, selon un dicton populaire. Comme moi, vous en avez certainement déjà fait l'expérience. Reste encore à savoir pourquoi on rit. Un rire cynique qui vise à tourner une personne en dérision, ce n'est pas un bon rire, à mon avis. En revanche, rire de bon cœur avec quelqu'un, c'est partager des moments de bonheur. Même les scientifiques le confirment. Vous allez peut-être vous demander pourquoi le président de la Confédération parle du rire en cette journée des malades, comme si une personne gravement malade avait envie de rire. Pourtant, l'effet thérapeutique de l'humour est désormais largement reconnu. Je songe notamment au clown de la Fondation Théodora qui, depuis plus de 20 ans, rend visite à des enfants hospitalisés. Et cela marche. Comme par magie, les visages des petits malades s'illuminent d'un sourire. Des animations avec des clowns sont aussi organisées dans les établissements médico-sociaux. Il y a 3 ans, l'Université de Zurich a réalisé la première étude au monde à ce sujet. Il en résulte que les personnes atteintes de démence éprouvent une joie réelle à la vision de ces clowns. Vous tous, vous pouvez offrir des moments de joie à vos proches qui tombent malades. Aucune formation n'est nécessaire. Il n'est toutefois pas rare que les malades eux-mêmes égaient leur entourage. Je l'ai vécu moi-même lors de notre dernière excursion du Conseil fédéral où nous avons visité un établissement médico-social. Les résidents âgés ou atteints dans leur santé nous ont accueillis avec un large sourire. Nous avons ri ensemble et l'espace d'un instant, la maladie était oubliée. Nous le savons tous, la maladie est synonyme de souffrance, d'angoisse et de tristesse, parfois même de deuil. Tout en gardant cette réalité à l'esprit, nous pouvons aussi rire et partager des moments de joie avec les malades. Quelques touches d'humour apportées avec doigté et respect ne sont pas interdites. En cette journée des malades, je tiens à remercier toutes les personnes qui, jour après jour, sont au chevet des malades. Mes remerciements vont tant au personnel soignant qu'aux proches. Les premiers font preuve d'un grand professionnalisme et les seconds apportent un soutien précieux par leur dévouement et leur affection. Merci à vous tous qui accompagnez des malades et leur offrez des petits moments de bonheur. Enfin et surtout, je m'adresse à vous, chers malades. Restez fort et confiant. Puissiez-vous, malgré vos souffrances, garder le sourire et vivre des moments de joie.
Raymond? Shadows.
Shadows. Very, very large shadows. You made an interesting remark about Swiss shadows. Maybe you should elaborate.
Okay. So maybe the longest shadows in the world, or the largest amount of long shadows in the world, are in Switzerland, because of the mountains, of course. And some villages, they only get light maybe only 1 hour a day when the sun shines, and for the rest of the day they are in a complete dark atmosphere, and it provokes a kind of behavior and a kind of it has physical consequences, because when there is no light, then you cannot see so much, and when there is no light, you can also, it's more easy not to be seen. And it also creates a kind of moisture, which provokes also maybe some, apart from moisture-related diseases, I don't know any for the moment, but it also creates a kind of mental health problems. I will make a very typical for me, but not typical in general,
observation.
I was with a good friend of mine. I was once in Berchtesgaden. In Berchtesgaden, it's in the south of Germany, and we were very curious to see how people from now were related to a kind of very dark place like Berchtesgaden. It's where Hitler had his eagle nest, or how is it called?
Eagle Nest.
Yeah. And then we could see this building. We were in a valley in the village, and there was a lot of shadow. But if you looked up, you saw like a very light, almost illuminated building, which belonged once to the Nazis. But Raymond, you also have special experiences with light and height.
I practice alpine skiing, so that means climbing up the mountain during winter and then skiing off one time. And this then, obviously, to make it worthwhile, you'll have to climb up for a while in order to get a good run out. And with Harald, when we were thinking about, you know, the correlation between height and the change of perspective, as for me, it's a very liberating practice, because once you wake up in 4 or 3 or 4 in the morning, get in the car, get out at the foot of the mountain at 6 o'clock in the morning, you start climbing, and around 12 o'clock, 1 o'clock in the afternoon, you're on the Spitze, on the highest point, let's say, and you know, that view I think has a very strong mental effect as well. It puts all, let's say, mortal problems into a new perspective once you see how small and tiny everything is or can be. I believe it grants a small boost in tranquility. And I think maybe for someone who was orchestrating the largest war in recent history, I think his mountain time or his view from this, let's say, illuminated building had a similar effect.
And to go back to the shadows, when I was talking to you about shadows, you came up with nostalgia.
Yeah, shadows. We were, I if I remember correctly, we were trying to place, we're trying to place the role of these small shadow villages and their population and their contribution, let's say, to the overall Swiss Seele, their Swiss soul. And we arrived quite quickly. We arrived at Plato's cave theory, and thinking about how if you stay in one of these villages, then in the dark completely for the largest part of a year, how it strangely resembles the absence of reality and sort of willing being locked up willingly in a certain sense, you know. And nostalgia, funny enough, is a word. It's not a true Greek word. It's a fake, made-up Greek word, coined by a Swiss doctor in the 1800s. As you well know, Switzerland is known for its mercenary armies throughout history, and we can still see traces of this, as for the Swiss Guard example in the Vatican. Those people still to this day are Swiss people. So the Swiss Guard are truly Swiss and get recruited in Switzerland and so forth and so forth. And there was a doctor, I think he was in Bern at the time, and he met a lot of mercenary soldiers coming back or going to wars or coming back from them. And they all would have these marvelous stories about their beautiful village and how spectacular the view was and how beautiful their little churches were and their cousins and their wives and everything. And this doctor was a little bit troubled by all these people having the same romantic visions of these places. And so he decided to join some of them to view these places, and then they would have a three-day hike in terrible conditions, arrive, and he would find one little abandoned church, three or four ugly houses on the verge of destruction, and some ugly people with severe vitamin shortages, and so bad teeth, bad skin, thin hair. And so he would constate that he understood that this was obviously a disease of the brain, and so he coined nostalgia for these sweet memories of places that in reality don't or never existed. And his remedies were opium, leeches, and bloodletting. So he would just advise you to open up a vein and sit over a bathtub for an hour, and then you would be better. And I believe you said something very interesting about, let's say, the Swiss condition that we could sometimes see, the temporal condition.
You mean with the past?
Yes, yeah. With every layer.
Yeah, it's because it's I also have a question for you, Ramon. Mm. But I'll wait. It's a kind of immobile situation where the past, the present, and the future they merge into one thing, and therefore they are transcendental and also completely stupid in a way, because
in the same.
Because it blocks any possibility to disentangle the past from the present and the future.
Mm-hmm.
But then I have a question for you,
mm-hmm.
because we were walking in Bern.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
I don't know if people, they probably everybody knows Bern or has seen a picture of Bern, but it's this kind of, 17th century, 16th yeah. century?
Earlier probably, yeah.
Everything looks the same, everybody looks the same. Everything is extremely oppressing. Even the hamburgers in McDonald's are extremely oppressing. But then you have my question is to you, Raymond. Once these buildings they were new.
Yes.
What was the atmosphere? Was there nostalgia when these buildings were new?
That's a very tricky, evil question. I don't know. We thought about it multiple times, because when we were in Biel, we saw a sign on one of the houses saying that Goethe stayed there for 3 years. In 17 something, and I remember you saying, yeah, but then at the time it was new, you know. But who says that? I mean, how, you know, how is that even a thing? It seems frozen in time. For example, one of the most interesting dynamics was that a certain person will call him Osobuco for anonymity reasons, told us that, so we have a contemporary person who has to deal, living day to day, has to deal with medieval plumbing situations where the entire plumbing of a building in Bern was made out of wood. So it was wooden plumbing, and obviously, yeah, it's not very durable. So they have to close the building and then replace, because of laws regarding history and conservation, they have to replace the whole wooden plumbing, closing the building, evicting everyone, and so forth, and so forth. So this very strange, almost, let's say, peer pressure from the past, almost, some sort of willing peer pressure of, at one side, extreme innovation and the best clinics and private care and assisted suicide and so forth, and at the same time being unable to make, let's say, Schlussmachen, close or be able to close with the past, I think is what for me is let's say typical or important to look at the Swiss condition, I think.
And Remo, how would you relate the industry of watches and clocks to what you just said?
Horrible questions, terrible.
Yeah, sorry.
we have one of the more important people, let's say, if we're talking about mechanics and watches, is Jacques Droche, who made the automatons, the more refined automatons in around 1700, yet again. And they infinitely repeat and write and sing. Some even make noises. I'm completely derailed by the
question.
Severe layering of your questions. Yes, but I remember a funny little observation you made about Swiss clocks, that they resemble, in a way, movement patterns of certain valley inhabitants, because they just stay inside of certain valleys and make the same trips every time. I think that was an interesting way of looking at things again.
You had a small video about the automatons, no?
I have a small video.
Can you show it to us?
I will show it.
Maybe Raymon, you can describe what we see.
We are looking at an collection, assistant and or let's say representative in Switzerland who works for Jacques Droche, which is obviously still producing. In this century, they are producing watches as for the past, but in the early beginning, they were very crafty, doll and automaton crafters. Now, I don't know if we should start talking about the history of automatons, because they surely are not a Swiss invention. But let's say that the Greeks already had very sophisticated human-like machines and or animals working with let's say simple but inventive mechanic systems. I'll try to share this. Is it visible, Harald?
Yeah.
And we see a little boy that was, but this is one of the automatons that write. So he dips his pen in ink and then proceeds to write a little message. I don't know, hi, je m'appelle Jaquette Rose or something like that. Yes. Maybe have you seen enough?
Yeah, I think we saw it in a way.
But I think the writing part is impressive, so maybe we should.
Klotemans. Yeah.
Talking about automatons, what would Klotemans be doing in Bern?
Klotemans.
Mm-hmm.
Klotemans. Did you see Klotemans?
I think I saw Klotemans.
Yeah, I will explain a bit. So Klotemans is a man with a beard who is in a constant levitation. If ever you go to Bern, I don't know, it's number 32 in the Postgasse, no?
Yeah, the Postgasse. Yeah.
Postgasse 32. There you can see through the window. You can see a man in levitation. So he is lying on a bed, but he's capable of floating, not very high, maybe 15 centimeters, 20 above the bed. And if you look a bit longer through the window, you will see like towels, because he likes towels for some reason. And the towels, they are pastel, so there are no red, blue, green, black, or white towels. No, there's one white towel with two tennis rackets. And then there is it's a very exciting story. There is a yellow, like a very bleak yellow towel and a very bleak blue towel. And this is the kind of colors that you get when you mix different primary colors. You You get like a very, I don't know, slimy colors in a way. And in a way, I think you can relate it to, because when beige is also a color, but the word is very disgusting in a way, I think.
Mm-hmm.
But it's when you mix things that there is no color almost anymore. And it made me think of the neutrality, like neutral colors.
Neutral like, colors.
Nobody can be angry on a neutral color. Because they're in a way very shy. They're shy or they hide themselves so that they are becoming invisible.
Mm.
And then I think we go back to the shadow thing because we met a man in Switzerland who had a atomic shelter in his
atomic
house.
Yes.
And
the private shadow, no?
Yeah, private shadow, a shadow nobody can take away from you in a way. And he also had a gun.
Very nice.
It was made in Switzerland. The gun. No?
Yes, completely.
Yeah.
He served and he kept, I think, his service weapon. But, it's... Ash reminds me of this some sort of parallel DDR site where you have a lot of beige and browns and off whites and écrus all joining in together. I don't think it's such an innocent color beige. I think you know neutrality is not necessarily being passive in a way. I think one can also be actively neutral, and that's maybe more aggressive than some people want to realize.
Maybe Raymond, we can show a fragment of the president of the extreme right wing party, the
SVP. Yeah.
So the Swiss.
So the culmination of.
And he's talking again about a kind of dark place. He's talking about the Gotthard Tunnel. So the tunnel between Switzerland and Italy. And we're not going to show it completely because that would be terror. But we can show maybe a small fragment. So he speaks like Schweizerdeutsch.
Severe Switzerdeutsch.
Yeah.
But he is.
Tell me.
No, he's dubbed the. He's one of the richest industrialists in Switzerland. Practically the culmination of this this time travel conundrum condition that we were talking about. So it seems like. It seems like you're talking or hearing a farmer in the last village in the Emmental, but in reality, it's one of the richest Swiss men that ever existed. And he's also been dubbed the Swiss Berlusconi. Just I don't know if this metric makes any sense, but he's had a profound and maybe severe impact on Swiss society. Are we going?
Yeah, I'll quickly describe the setting.
Nein.
So I think we're in the home of Blocher,
Christoph Blocher,
with an older man with a black suit and a yellow tie in front of a chimney and a painting by a Swiss artist.
100%.
Yeah. And he's like in a very good mood, and he talks about the dignity and the kind of humble the
importance of the Gotthard, no, as a mountain, no.
Yeah, but also the tunnel.
Yeah, the tunnel. Yeah, of course.
But we'll show you a very small fragment where he's talking about the tunnel. Sorry, it's
until he gets
boring.
Excited. No, I think that's the only part that we really want to see.
Yeah.
Ich meine, der Gotthard ist ja hochinteressant. Das weitere der sieht man da den Tunnel macht. Sondern das ist der zentrale Punkt von der Schweiz. Ohne Gotthard gäbe es keine Schweiz. Ohne Gotthard gäbe es keinen Freiheitsbrief gegeben. Das ist die kürzeste Verbindung von Norden nach Süden, weil man nur durch einen Berg tun muss. Im Gotthard haben wir Sedwick gehabt. Und mich hat es am meisten gefreut, dass der Umgott Leuenberg und der linke 68er, die über den Gotthard gespäuzt haben und gesagt haben, hör mal auf mit dieser Vergelterin vom Gotthard, schurmanisch gefragt, dass der am Schluss müssen sie die Rede Gotthard hineinhalten. Das hat man jetzt wirklich genug.
Aber das hat er also ungern gemacht, haben wir gesehen?
Nein, er hat überall gern. Wenn er vor allem auch über sich reden. Wenn du mal schaust, die Reden sind ja alles über sich. Also ich habe die vier ein unappetitliche gefunden. Wenn du mal schauen, wie die Tunnel durchsticht sind. Und du warst natürlich auch mühsamer gewesen. Der erste Tunnel von Gotthard.
Vor
100 Jahren,
ja.
Ja, der Ritter ist selber, der die ganze Sache gemacht hat und noch finanziert hat. Dann hat er noch Kreditanstalt gegründet, damit wir den Klotzen zum Tunnel bauen. Der ist nicht sich so feiern, dort mit der Leitung. Sondern der hat gefeiert. Die Arbeiter, die hat fest bekommen, bescheiden auch, hat er gewusst, dass das ein Risiko ist.
We were almost there. We were almost there.
Ah, shit, yeah, sorry. Excuse me.
No, but it's fine.
No, go ahead. Sorry.
Musik machen und die haben keinen Bezug mehr zum Leben. Aber sich selber haben sie gefeiert und übertreibt und alles. Also, es ist einfach ein Weg vom praktischen Leben. Also, so habe ich es gelesen. Ich bin nicht dabei gewesen, oder? Und was, 7 Stunden im Fernsehen übertreibt, oder? Ich meine, das ist alles verschobenes Zeug. Dann wacht es im Grind. Und dann zu 100 Mal sagen, ach, der längste Tunnel von der Welt. Hör doch auf mit diesen Superlativ, oder? New York, das World Trade Center, dann ist das höchste Gewalt von der Welt, oder? Höchste Gewalt, wie hat das höchste Gewalt? Da war ein Schick-Tack, das war ein Flugzeug. Alles, nicht da fertig, oder? Ich bin in New York nie das World Trade Center gegangen.
I think this is,
Raymond, we have 5 minutes.
Oh my God, already?
Yeah, because if we had more minutes, we could show the daughter of Blocher.
Oh no. But wait, do you still want to show the Landsmann fragments?
Yeah, maybe we can describe the daughter... Who is like a caricature of her father?
Magdalena Blocher.
Magdalena Blocher.
She. Yeah.
But
5 minutes is not even going to cover the Landsmann fragments. I think it's better if you just show Magdalena and call it quits. No? What do you think?
You think so?
But. If we have 5 minutes.
Wait.
Oui. Okay. Describe Blocher.
but maybe you can describe the fragment that we won't see.
Ah, the Lanzmann fragment.
Yeah, or no, ooh. Or we show the very last part of that fragment, and you explain a little bit before.
The Lanzmann fragment.
Yeah, and you.
I think the Lanzmann. Before. The Lanzmann fragment is to all of you who know name Lanzmann, obviously not going to be a light fragment, but it's a forgotten film, I think, or a less known film, which is an interview of Maurice Rossel. Which is who was a member of the Swiss Red Cross and who traveled to Berlin in 1942 to be part of the mission. And Lanzmann asks him questions like, how was it to interact with the Germans? And he said, yeah, we were always under under Swiss people, and it's maybe turns a little bit back to this this active neutrality which we were talking about earlier, it's a very very strange interview, because it was true in a sense that Lanzmann just arrived at the house of Rossel and started filming, so it has a degree of reality to it. But which fragment do you want to show, Harald?
Maybe the very last one, or what do you think?
No, that's fine. That's okay.
But maybe only a part of it, or.
Yeah, because there is two parts. One when he talks about Auschwitz, and he can't stop talking about the blue eyes of the camp commandant and how elegant and friendly he was.
Maybe we can show that one.
Ah, yeah, okay. But just a small information. When the I guess all of you know Metropolis by Fritz Lang. And so one of the actresses is Jesus Christ, my brain. It hurts, make it stop. It keeps going. I'm showing the fragment. Enough suffering.
What are you going to show then, now?
I'm going to show the observation of Rossel that when he went to visit Oświęcim, the Polish village of Oświęcim, and Auschwitz, subsequently, obviously. We selected this little strange interview with the silk pistache pastel shirt because all the observations he makes about his trip to Auschwitz are the wrong ones, all of them. They seem actively neutral and, I don't know, maybe... Do you have something to add, Harald?
No. Can you put it a bit louder?
Je suis arrivé en finalement au bon.
Qu'est-ce que vous avez dit à tous les contrôles qui vous arrêtaient?
Je vais voir le commandant. Je vais à la commandant. Mes papiers de délégué international de la Croix-Rouge. C'est tout. Vous savez, j'étais bien inoffensif, je ne leur faisais pas peur. Hein. Je vous garantis, si la peur devait se sentir, ben non. On essayait un peu de plastronner, mais on n'était pas tellement dans son assiette. Surtout quand on est vraiment absolument seul. Je suis arrivé dans cette convention où j'ai été reçu frais correctement par le commandant du camp. Vous savez qui c'est, je ne me souviens plus, mais il est dans les papiers, je pense, du DSCR. Et c'était un jeune homme très élégant, bien aux yeux bleus, très distingué, très aimable. Veuillez prendre place, est-ce que je peux vous offrir un café, est-ce que nous avons fait, qu'est-ce qui vous amène ici, enfin, mon rêve. Je dis, mais moi je viens ici vous proposer cela. Il dit, ah, puis vous êtes suisse. Tiens, où je suis. J'aime beaucoup la Suisse, j'ai fait des courses de bob en Suisse, à Rosa, ou je ne sais où, Davos plutôt, Saint-Moritz.
Just to underline the absurdity of the lightness of being in Auschwitz and having coffee in Auschwitz and talking about bobsleighing in St. Moritz.
Je ne sais pas, il a fait du bob. De toute façon, on voulait me faire sentir qu'il était de la société qui pouvait faire du bob, n'est-ce pas? Moi, comme fils d'ouvrier, j'avais vu du bob, j'ai jamais eu le moyen d'aller m'offrir les grisons pour faire du bob. Alors, on a parlé de choses et d'autres, et je lui dis, ben voilà la situation, là aussi.
Ça va?
We have slowly to end our conversation.
But so soon, we just got started. Yeah.
Exactly.
Can I add two last things I think are important?
Yeah, tell us.
The Swiss mission was staying in the villa of Brigitte Helm. I finally got it. And she was the actress of, she was the robot in Metropolis by Fritz Lang, and she fled Germany because the NSDAP had taken over the entire cinema business. So this is what I wanted to correct. And Maurice Rossel is responsible for almost, you could say, the first misinformation surrounding the Holocaust, as his reports as a Red Cross observer were severely inaccurate and didn't portray the reality of as well Auschwitz as Theresienstadt. And so the conflict between his reports and several other European reports created a lot of conflict and problems, let's say, for the after-war period and true history.
thank you, Raymond. Hello?
Hello?
thank you. I will call you in a minute.
Okay. Ciao, ciao, ciao.
With the wine. Yeah, thank you very much.